DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn, Germany. On this week's show, with recent hurricanes leaving parts of the U.S. South and Latin America reeling, we look to the Dutch, the masters of coastal flooding protection. But it's not all that serious this week on Spectrum. We're going to take a trip through the Florida Everglades in search of pythons. And we'll also look at how one man is trying to honor the victims of roadkill. There is much more than that on this episode of Spectrum, so please stay with me on DW's Science Weekly.
Robin, I've been trying to find the words. Ferocious doesn't seem to even be enough for how this storm has intensified.
The devastation wrought in Puerto Rico by Hurricane Maria is quite literally incomprehensible. Within hours, the storm wiped out over 80% of the Latin American island's crop value. Just 1 week after the widespread flooding in Texas and Florida, entire plantations in Puerto Rico were laid to waste. It seems every time a major coastal flood happens, whether it be due to torrential rains or hurricanes, the world's admonishing eye turns to the Dutch. Or at least it should, perhaps. Around one-fifth of the Netherlands is below sea level. And in 1953, there was a horrific flood, known to the Dutch as the Watersnoodramp, that cost 2,000 people their lives. Ever since, the country has been building and maintaining an enormous barrier system. At the moment, 15 barriers protect the country against the North Sea. My colleague Nele Rösler went to check out one of those barriers, the Oosterscheldekering, and spoke with Freek Titselaar, a guide there.
Eastern Scheld storm surge barrier is very special because it's always open. And we close it when the weather conditions are very bad. When the sea level rises 3 meters above zero point, so to speak, and the winds come from the northwest, then conditions can be dangerous, and then we close it. And since 86, we closed it about 25 times.
And that works for the environment, so the environment is still rich here. Yeah.
Because it's still open, the water, the seawater, can enter the Eastern Scheld estuary. It's an estuary nowadays, and your water life is very rich.
You said you're a scuba diver.
I'm a scuba diver myself, and I can tell you it's very, very rich. I'm always astonished by the richness of the marine life here in the Eastern Scheld estuary. And many divers come here to witness that. For us, it's very important. Diving is an important sport here in this region.
On the technical side, how does the Oosterscheldekering work?
Well, you push a button, so to speak, and we got 62 steel doors, and they close within an hour. So it's the dam is 9 kilometers long, and it takes about an hour to close it. So when they close the dam, the Eastern Scheld and the North Sea are separated. So the water from the North Sea can no longer enter the Eastern Scheld.
And that's for just round about 3 hours?
More or less, yes. Not too long, because it's very important for us. Marine life, and especially bird life, they depend from low tide, because during low tide they can go and forage on the sandbars.
Other dams in the Netherlands are normally closed, aren't they?
Yeah, more or less closed, yeah, sure. In the north we have the Grevelingen Dam. That's a closed dam. And, when you, for instance, I told you I'm a scuba diver, so when I dive there during the summer, below 10, 15 meters, marine life is dead, because due to oxygen levels. There is no oxygen and no nutrients. So now they opened it in the eastern part of the Grevelingen Dam. There is also a dam, a closed dam, and they made an opening. So nourishment and fresh water and oxygen-rich water can pour in.
So when the Oosterscheldekering is closed, for those few hours, is that a problem for the birds?
Not at all. Not at all. Because it's only 2-3 hours maximum, and during low tide, and there is low tide, they can have dinner, so to speak.
Okay. So they are on the land for 3 hours and
no
then
problem.
It's fine.
Yeah.
How much do the Netherlands spend for reopening other dams?
I have no idea, but that's a lot of money, but I have no idea.
And how did it come that this dam is built in an open way?
Well, originally they planned to build a closed dam, but then halfway they amended the plan, and nowadays it's half open, and this was due to environmental issues. And there was a lot of protest going on in those days. I mean, environmental issues, they date back from the 70s. So people were worried about the consequences. So they didn't want marine life to deteriorate. And fishermen, I mean, this is a very important region. People are growing mussels here and also oysters. So there was a massive protest. And then the government amended the plans. They altered the plans and they changed it into an open dam.
The Oosterscheldekering is part of the Delta project.
Yep.
The whole plans for that, when did that start?
The original plans, they date back to the 20s and 30s. But then we had a war, and then in 53 we had a major flood. And after the major flood, all the projects came into existence.
Another of the areas seriously affected by Hurricane Irma were Florida's Everglades. A bizarre place, if you think about it, for people to be living at all. One thing's for sure, though, even if many residents choose to pack their bags after Irma, tourism will continue to fly here. It's the airboat rides that are particularly popular, with cameras waiting to snap at the area's most famous snapping predator, the alligator. But now there's a new kid in town, the Burmese python. The population of these giant snakes in the Everglades is booming, at the cost of pretty much everything around it. Native species in Everglades National Park have seen a sharp decline. One Burmese python was even found with an adult deer in its belly this past fall. Pythons do have a voracious appetite. Maria Bakalapalu traveled to the Florida Everglades to find out more.
The Everglades once covered the whole of South Florida, a vast shallow river teeming with life. Now its eastern edge is defined by the city of Miami. To the north, sugar plantations have prospered. With a large human population drawn to the sunny climate, development has been incessant, and the tropical ecosystems have suffered. Today, the Everglades is half of its former size. 68 endemic species here are threatened or endangered, a lot of it due to invasive species, especially the Burmese python. Local surveys show population of raccoons and possums have dropped by over 90%. Bobcats, more than 87%. And pythons have all but wiped out the reintroduced marsh rabbit. The Burmese python has become so dominant that it is giving the longtime apex predator, the alligator, some stiff competition. The climate conditions and abundance of prey in the Everglades means pythons thrive. One female can lay up to 100 eggs. Various state agencies have responded by launching python hunts. They have caught over 100 so far.
Rolling, rolling, rolling. Get those pythons rolling.
Meet Thomas Rahill, founder of the Swamp Apes, a group mostly made up of military veterans, dedicated to combating invasive animals and plants in the Everglades. The program gives the vets a chance to be reintroduced into civilian life and use their training to help save the wetland area.
Pythoning is nothing like you'd expect it to be, but it's everything you'd hope for. To drive on a road at night, bright spotlight, and you're looking for a shadow, large dark shadow across the road. And then you get out and you hopefully successfully capture the python if you come across it. Pythons are beautiful, but they are causing such harm.
For hours upon hours, they drive along the levees, hoping for something to slither past. It might be hanging from a tree or warming itself on the road, or they might spend a whole week of 12-hour days looking and find nothing, like this evening. There are financial and ecological reasons to keep going, but it's also kind of addictive. The landscape is spectacular, with an ecosystem like no other, because it derives its water from rainfall.
We'll start with the back end here. This animal came in with a prolapsed colon.
Christopher Smith and Andrea Zimendi are Swamp Apes board members and animal veterinarians at the Wellaby Veterinary Hospital in Sunrise, Florida. Here you can hear them examine a python.
He does have a couple of sutures there that are keeping it in place.
They help state agencies locate and study Burmese pythons using tracking devices. They also train new swamp apes to restrain the massive constrictor when they find one. No mean feat, given they can grow up to 20 feet.
Yeah, you generally want to control the most dangerous aspect of the animal, which in their case is their mouth at first. So if you're able to grab behind their skull and restrain that way, and then you're able to better control their body.
Christopher and Andrea hold a 5-foot male python on an examination table to check its health and give it some antibiotics. In 2010, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission signed rules that prohibit anyone from owning Burmese pythons and other reptiles of concern as pets. Little is known about the Burmese python, and even less about how it lives in the Everglades.
The relationships that happen in any ecosystem are exceptionally complex. And when you throw something into that ecosystem that's not supposed to be there, you can see some very obvious abnormalities. The mammal populations start to drop, the biodiversity starts to plummet. But how do those ripple effects start to go outwards? I don't even know that we have a grasp of that yet.
So far, hunters have bagged just over 100 Burmese pythons since the hunt started, one nearly 17 feet long and weighing in just over 65 kilos. All pythons must be euthanized, their eggs destroyed, before leaving the Everglades. It's a drop in the ocean, considering the population here is estimated anywhere from 10,000 to 100,000. But it's an enthusiastic start, and so far the best defense the Everglades has against this reptilian invasion. For DW, I'm Maria Bacalopoulou in the Everglades.
Speaking of dead deer, and with that Burmese python taken care of one last fall, a really sickening sight from where I come from, the Midwest, is deer carcasses on the side of the road that have been hit by cars. In many parts of the world, roadkill is often left to decompose for weeks at a time. But could there be a better way of honoring their lives rather than just leaving them there as roadkill? After the family cat got run over, Dutch artist Bart Jansen wanted to keep his memory alive. So in the spirit of conservation, he turned his beloved pet into a drone. Our reporter Joel Carnegie met up with Bart and his friend Arjen Beltman as they demonstrated their high-tech creation, the flying cat, in Arnhem, the Netherlands.
When his pet cat died, Dutch artist Bart Jansen came up with the unusual solution as to how to keep him close.
I popped him in the freezer, actually. I was going to build him a monument from day one, but I just didn't know what yet.
Roadkill, Bart explains, has always fascinated him.
I've been picking up dead animals since I was a kid. I used to prod dead fish with sticks and smell it and try not to vomit. All things biology have always interested me. In 2007, I made this book about the Dutch roadkill. So I picked up roadkill for 3 months and I crudely dried and taxidermied them and popped them in a book. So I ended up with this 60 kilo heavy book, which smelled really badly. It's called The Observer's Book of Roadkill.
And there's only one copy.
There's only one copy, yeah, but it's official. And then someone ran over my cat after that project. I just had to do something. And I said, Arjen, do you want to help me make my cat into a helicopter? He raised his eyebrow and said, all right. And from there it went.
So, that's a transmitter for Orville.
Having named the cat Orville, after Orville Wright, okay, one of the first men to fly,
ready to fly,
Bart decided to launch his cat into the air, using its stretched-out body as a drone. But Orville isn't the only animal that Bart and Arjen have created.
Someone called me up and he said, I found a dead badger on the side of the road. You want it? I was like, yeah, definitely want it. And now we got a badger submarine. It blew up the other day, though. You know, it was boating along quite you know, jolly. And then all of a sudden it stopped reacting and we didn't know what was happening. And then when we opened it up, it came apart with like a puff of yellow smoke that fell to the ground right away. It was like this bubble of smoke that went like... It stank like burnt electronics. Now we got a water-cooled engine. It's going to be great.
Assisting Bart with his taxidermy drone creations is mechanical engineer Arjen Beltman.
This is ostrich copter. It's 12 kilowatts electric, so it's sort of a beast in the drone world. Excuse me, I gotta concentrate. Here. Do not make any mistakes, otherwise we'll have explosions. Okay, here we go. Are you ready? Now this is the sound of a flying ostrich.
It's a big fella, isn't it?
Where did you find the ostrich?
At a farm. There's about 9 ostrich farms in Holland. I received one that, unfortunately, it turned sick and fell over one day. And I got an ostrich in the back of my little Volkswagen. When you ever get a dead ostrich in your wagon, tip it over first, because everything relaxes once an animal's dead. And so also the big muscle down there. And it emptied about, I don't know, 10 pounds of yellow goo inside my car, and I drove back home with the windows open, wondering what project I was doing now. What are we doing? It was horrible. Arjen and I looked at each other like, okay, let's do a sequel.
And then there's Ratatouille, the flying rat, Sharkjet, the flying shark, and their latest challenge, a flying cow, which is set to house a human pilot. So, is it going to work?
I don't know. Do we need a stewardess on board?
Selling some refreshments.
Refreshments. The bar will open soon.
Cow Airways.
Yeah.
Wonder if you get miles.
Maybe. You get free milk. Free milk for everyone.
But there's a serious side to this too. Bart says that his inventions are designed to highlight the flaws in our race for technological progress and how we can get so caught up in the cycle of buying more and more.
Humanity is addicted to new things, to this technological progress. But people try to solve problems by inventing a machine that solves the problem for them. But half of these machines make more and more problems. Like, we're stuck in this technological race. I put a lot of effort in making something work that no one has any use for. I pick up this idea where humanity goes completely wrong and then make fun of it by making a machine about it.
So Bart continues to tinker away in his workshop, expanding and caring for his menagerie of kooky creatures.
For my day job, I install solar panels. I do that, yeah, because we need to eat. And, well, it starts to pay off, the art, but it's not there yet, and need to pay the bills. And trying to do something for the world at the same time, so I install solar panels.
And is there anything you won't touch? Is there no limit to what you think you can do with this collection of animals?
I do a blue whale. It's like 30 centimeters of blubber. Make that fly. I don't know. Nah, I probably wouldn't do, because you can't taxidermy a whale. It can't be done. It's too greasy.
Do you have any current pets?
Yeah, I got Wilbur, Orville's brother, still there. Probably become a hot air balloon when his time has come.
I wonder what he thinks about that.
I don't know.
Have you told him?
No, I haven't.
You might need to have that conversation at some point.
Yeah.
Joel Carnegie, DW, Arnhem, the Netherlands.
We're going to turn now to the story of a brother and a sister in their 20s who are determined to transform the way Burkina Faso consumes and saves water and electricity. They have set up a social enterprise called Farafina Eco Engineering. Bram Postumus met them in their brand new office in Ouagadougou.
This new ventilator is not running on solar energy yet, but its first rotations were not without difficulty, as you can hear. It got better later. Mind you, with an outside temperature of 44 degrees Celsius, you need fresh air. From early March to early June, it is very hot here, and the need for water and electricity is great. This is the challenge for the brains behind Farafina Eco Engineering.
I'm Semboro Ali. I've just finished my study in hydraulic engineering.
My name is Khadija Semboro. I am from Burkina. I'm working on fields of renewable energy and energy efficiency.
Indeed, brother and sister, both followed similar paths to get to where they are today.
1992, I was born in Ouagadougou, and I do my school year. After secondary, I integrate 2IE International Institute for Water and Environmental Engineering in Ouagadougou, and I get my master.
I start my education with primary school. After certification, I went to high school. I done a bachelor degree at A-level in science and mathematics. We was only two girls in my classroom. My brother, my family, my parents very support me. That's what I go ahead, why I go ahead. It's very important for girls to be support.
With the help of their parents, friends, scholarships, they made it through their engineering courses. Both are working in areas where the needs are enormous: water and electricity. In fact, you can only be guaranteed these two amenities if you live in a town or a city. And even there, these services can be cut at any time, especially during the hottest months of the year. With that in mind, Ali and Khadija started their company.
Our project is to sensitize people, to educate them, and after to propose them some innovative solution that can allow them to reduce waste consumption.
Reducing consumption is a must in a country where you hear this. Only from June to September. So Ali and Khadija sell drip feeders for plants at home or in the office. You will use 30% less water that way. And they sell solar-powered motion detectors, so you don't have to keep the lights on all night to keep the burglars away.
My goal is to provide electricity to my village. I went to the village for vacation, and whole time we have on dark because we not have electricity in my village. We are planning to be focused on rural area.
Both of them freely admit that it's not easy being a startup. They're writing a business plan, they're hoping to use crowdfunding to expand their services, and they welcome anyone who wants to give them a helping hand. So with all that, where do they see themselves in 5 years?
In 5 years? Wow! In 5 years, I want our organization to be great, help like more than more than 1 million people.
In 5 years, I dream our company will be the number one company, the reference for energy and water sector in West Africa.
You heard it here first. Watch out for these two. They are only just beginning. And you can follow their progress and share ideas with them on Facebook.
We have a Facebook page, and in this page we continue to share advices to help population to save energy and water.
And the name?
Farafina.ecoengineering.
For our final story this week, researchers in the south of Germany are harnessing the power of the sun to keep milk cold. Bear with me on this one. The company Feisun has created an efficient milk cooling unit that relies on solar energy. The project is currently being tested in Tunisia and Kenya, where small dairy farmers don't always have access to refrigerating systems to store their milk, and for keeping it cool during transport. Gerland Folmer went to find out more, and her report is presented by my colleague Natalie Muller.
It's a sunny day in the southern German town of Memmingen. And just as well, Dirk Gutzeit is about to give a demonstration of the special solar device that he helped design. The engineer has just dragged his equipment out to Faizan's company car park. He hitches up the white refrigeration system to a strategically placed solar module, and the magic begins. The sun's rays are beating down, perfect conditions for making ice, with energy from the sun. The solar-powered freezer can produce 6 to 8 kilograms of ice at a time, enough to keep 30 litres of milk cool for 12 hours. Gutzeit opens the unit and carefully removes a couple of large cylinders of ice, frozen solid. then slides them into a custom-built compartment inside an insulated milk can. The whole contraption works as an environmentally friendly cooling system that keeps milk from going bad, Goodside explains.
You don't have any more milk going off, and that means up to 30% bigger deliveries to dairies. So the system will pay for itself within 2 or 2.5 years.
The price tag for the equipment is 3,000 euros, or just under $3,500. It's conceived of, above all, for use in places like rural Africa that lack reliable connections to the electricity grid. In terms of Germany, that amount is a mere fraction of the cost of automatic milking systems typically used here, where raw milk is sent directly to massive refrigerated storage tanks, not transported in small canisters. Still, the company wanted to test their product on local farmers, so they've come here to visit Josef Friedl. The organic dairy farmer, clad in green overalls and a green cap, has agreed to give the milk cooling can a go.
Die Milch, die wir gemolken haben.
Our milk goes straight into the tank and is cooled there. In other countries, it goes in here.
He points to the company's metal canister, which he fills with fresh milk from his cows. Then he opens slots in the special compartment for the ice and fills them with three large blocks from the solar-powered freezer. Friedl isn't used to this kind of time-consuming and back-breaking way of working. His farm is equipped with a lot of labour-reducing devices, but the farmer says he could appreciate how the cooling can could work for a smallholder in Africa.
The technology is very simple, so there's not a lot that can go wrong. In Germany, we usually have a lot of technology, so a lot can go wrong. And this can hold quite a bit. 30 litres is a fair amount.
Intensive industrial-style farming in Germany means milk output is relatively high, but in Africa, one cow produces just 5 litres of milk a day, so the 30-litre can would be big enough for a small herd of cattle. Not only does the invention use renewable energy to prevent food waste, it could also help reduce bacterial growth in milk that has to be stored or transported. This makes the milk healthy and safer for human consumption. So, how well does it work? Friedl sticks a thermometer into the raw milk. After 10 minutes, the 3 6-kilo blocks of ice have cooled down the milk considerably.
It's 28 degrees now. A 10-degree reduction in heat is a lot for such a short time.
That's good news for Tobias Schwerner. He's the managing director of Faizan, which developed the system in cooperation with the University of Hohenheim, just outside of Stuttgart in Germany.
Up to now, our goal has been to help smallholders with 2 to 3 cows in tropical and subtropical regions, because they have the greatest need to cool their milk right after milking.
The first pilot trials are taking place in Sidi Bouzid in Tunisia. 10 dairies there have been equipped with off-grid solar modules and refrigerator boxes, which were produced in southern Germany. The project is being funded with German development aid. Here's Schwerner again.
We're already conducting a second pilot trial in Kenya, which has a slightly different focus. And we're working on the commercial side of things. We've put together a set, which has an article number and can be ordered via Faizan.
In parts of rural Kenya, milk is often handled by small-scale farmers that organise themselves into cooperatives. Bikes and motorbikes are used to transport the milk from the farm to collecting points, where it's bulked for wholesale. The Faizan engineers haven't actually seen firsthand how their cooling system is being used in Kenya yet, but they do get sent updates and photos from time to time.
Look, Dirk, we've got the latest photos from the milk cooling system in Kenya.
He cycles to the cow.
Right.
The team hope to refine their cooling equipment based on the outcome of further tests. But in the meantime, more prototypes from the company's offices in southern Germany are on their way to Africa. Now, that transport just needs to be made carbon neutral to also benefit the environment.
And that's all the time we have this week. I sincerely hope you've been informed or at least interested by this edition of Spectrum. You can download the program at dw.com/spectrum. And as always, if you've got a comment you want us to hear about, please tweet us or send us an email at spectrum@dw.com. I'm Gabriel Bord from all of us here at DW. Have a wonderful week ahead.